Good morning. Welcome to our roundtable discussion this morning. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome you to our panel discussion roundtable at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the panel to you this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. WAMC newsman Ray Graff is in the house. Good morning, Raymond.
Hello, all.
And our wonderful newsman, Mike Spain, who also happens to moonlight as associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain joins us.
Gee, I hope my boss isn't listening. Well, happy Friday, everybody.
Yeah, it's good to have you here, and thank you very much for being here so often this week. I appreciate it. It's very, very nice of you.
Happy to be here.
We welcome your comments, as I mentioned, roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also do the Facebook thing, the webpage thing, or the tweet thing.
Unless you're in Turkey.
That's right.
Yeah.
Unless you are in Turkey, and that is another issue, isn't it? So let us get going on to what is happening in the world. And I don't know where I was thinking we would start with, with Russia. But if anybody else has anything any requests?
No, I like Russia. I like Russia. I think it's a very interesting story.
Let's talk about the new sanctions. Obama expands sanctions against top aides, associates of Putin over annexation of Crimea. And in return, Vladimir Putin said that John Boehner couldn't come to Russia. So I
And McCain.
So here we go. And
Harry Reid.
And doesn't that does that put it into some context of exactly how kind of silly all of this this sanction business is?
Yeah, I think the sanction stuff, Joe, is a little bit misplaced. I think the most important story coming out of Russia yesterday is the crash of their stock market.
Right.
Because I think that that's really what it's all about. You know, in the end, there was supposed to be just one superpower. I don't take any great credit for the United States for this, but it's a huge thing. And we already see a story in the Times today that Putin is backing down and saying, okay, enough now. We don't need any more of this. But superpowerhood has economic powerhood too. And I think that is something that they've really got to worry about.
Well, what do the United States and Europe hope to gain by putting Russia through this hardship? Is it to keep him keep Putin from continuing the expansionism and moving into eastern Ukraine? Or
Mike, I think that's right.
Yeah. Or is it also part of some expected protocol that's supposed to happen? It's almost like, you know, you do this, I do that. It's tit for tat. And you know, there's no expectation that he's going to back off of the.
No.
Right.
No. But of course, you're right. But there's one you didn't mention just now when you made the laundry list, and that's the political needs of the leaders. So if you have a guy like Obama and his critics, of whom we know all about, are saying he's a weak president, he's not doing enough, they take that stuff very seriously because it goes right to the political bottom line.
When it comes to, it seems hard, and we've been talking about this for several weeks now, but it seems hard to sort of know what's going to happen next. But you can only assume that there's going to continue to be this back and forth, again, tit for tat, that will, okay, you do this, we'll do this, you do this, we'll do this. And I don't know at what point that starts to break down.
Well, as I said, Joe, there is a story in the Times this morning that seems to indicate that it's already breaking down. That
economy,
okay, this.
Right? And the president said in the third round of sanctions that they want to have some sort of economic effect,
which it is having, and we saw that in their stock market yesterday. Look. They can't possibly win on this. The only thing that they can win is getting Crimea and keeping it, which is, I think, as though you guys have just indicated, exactly what's going to happen. They're going to keep it now. There's been this sort of realignment. If there was any thought that he might go somewhere else and be adventuresome, I think that's now off the table, but maybe I'm wrong.
So how does the president come out? of this?
I think he's okay. I mean, I think he's okay. I don't think the American people want any more confrontation. I don't think they want any more troops abroad. But if the only thing that the United States gives up here is Crimea, I think grudgingly most people will understand it, because there are so many. You know, there are so many variables that have to do with this. What happened with the Russians? How they gave it back? How it was always Russian? How they were all the Russian speakers, even if they were put there by Stalin, in a bad move to make sure that they control things. But I do think it's over. I may be wrong.
I was just wondering if anybody has seen polling in the U.S. on this and what people feel that we should do as a nation. Has anybody
seen
anything?
I did see a poll, yeah. And let me see if I can pull it up real quick. It was fairly supportive of the president's actions, if I remember correctly, and I believe it was from earlier this week. But let me just see if I can pull this up real quick.
While you're doing it, Joe, I'll read Nick Hardy's note to us at roundtable at WMC.org, who says, Russia, how about FIFA taking the World Cup away from Russia in 2018?
Okay. Yeah, sure.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. I thought his tongue was in his cheek. No?
No, I don't think so.
It would be an insult. I mean, Putin really liked the Olympics, even though it cost him.
It cost him a lot.
As the crisis in the Ukraine continues, a new national poll indicates that for the first time more than a decade, more than half of Americans see Russia as a serious threat to the United States. A CNN international survey released Friday, so this is today, yes, also indicates that Russian President Vladimir Putin's unfavorable rating among Americans has soared over the past month, and the poll indicates that the vast majority of the public says Moscow's actions in the neighboring Ukraine break international law, and half of those questions say a new Cold War between the U.S. and Russia is likely.
And here we go. You see, I think, look, we were all trained that way. They were all trained that way. I'd love to know, Joe, if the information's there, probably not, what the demographic age breakdown was. I mean, you know, we were hiding under, as Mike has said before and Ray said, we were hiding under our desks, you know, when I was a kid.
Duck and
that
cover.
Takes a long
I do that
errands.
Now, actually. Yeah. Fairly often in the office.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
By the way, I think I owe you an apology, Raymond, just for whatever it's worth. And, well, I came home yesterday, and, you know, we had that little tiff about the weavers and whether violins should have been behind
them.
Oh, you know?
No, I don't remember that.
And I came home, and Roselle just lit into me. She said, why did you treat that poor man so badly over that? That was a legitimate opinion, and I happen to agree with him. So I want to abjectly apologize.
I thought we were kidding
taking offense.
Okay.
Well, you and I both, we were kidding around, weren't we? And we were both laughing. But you can't always tell that. You can't always tell that on the radio. Yeah, okay.
For the record, it was all kidding around.
Yeah, no, it always is.
What? Okay. Let's take a break. We'll be back right after this.
Support for WAMC comes from Haydenville Woodworking and Design, South Deerfield, Massachusetts. Over 20 years offering construction and millwork services, installing their cabinets throughout New England, and shipping their furniture nationwide. HaydenvilleWD.com. St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York. Offering minimally invasive spine surgery, choose stmarys.com. And University of New Hampshire. Offering an online Master of Social Work program, now accepting applications for admission in August, mswonline.unh.edu.
Second guessing you 'cause you won't even let me through.
Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We want to talk a little bit about the, of course, the Malaysian airliner. And so are we, this is, we're at the end of week two, right?
Yeah, I think it's day 14 now.
Yeah, day 14. So here we are, and Mike made an interesting observation during the break, and it's one that is echoed on the front page of the New York Times, and that is, so now, and even picking up on what Ira Fussfeld was saying yesterday on the program about the, you know, the lack of news and the speculation, but now it's become very much the news is about the technology of what we do to find things that are lost like this. The article in the Times says the airline industry has sophisticated tools to follow planes and stream data from their flight recorders, but given cost and the general safety of air travel, neither the airlines nor regulators have adopted them. So now you add on to that the technology that is being used in submarines and other vessels that are trying to go through the ocean to pick up something to find some remnants of the plane in a huge area, an amazingly large area. And meanwhile, before I throw this over to the entire group, we, of course, have the story that continues about the possibility of the plane debris off the coast of Australia, where they have dispatched all of these various forms of travel, and nobody has seen anything, so they can't confirm what they have found on the satellite pictures,
yeah.
Which were anywhere from 8 feet to like 40 feet, something like that.
There were some large items. Yeah.
Yes, and then they had engineers coming on and saying, "Well, there really wouldn't be anything that large unless it is sort of wires and various things that have through the tumult of the ocean have sort of created something that large, but a part itself probably wouldn't be that large."
And it's also about the size of a container. Item, you know, a container that goes on a container ship, and which often fall into the ocean and float around, you know. So it's now you just don't even know.
How does that happen? A huge 79-foot container falling off a ship, and that's common?
Well,
do they use bungee cords? How do they keep them on?
No, I mean, there's a lot written about it. I mean, there was a famous case where, you know, ships have gone down or containers, they've hit, you know, rocky waves, I guess, and they've fallen into the ocean, and sneakers then, you know, are on their way from China, end up in the middle of the ocean, and then they use the sneakers to study ocean tides for years. If these sneakers, you know, come up on the shore of Alaska or on the shore of Washington State, and they measure all that kind of stuff. I mean,
then they end up on telephone wires.
That's right. But I mean, the point is that there's just all kinds of debris out there for all kinds of reasons, and perhaps this might be that. But as the Australian said, this is the best chance we have at this point, and they're going for it.
The best quote, and by that I mean chilling, but the best quote that I heard yesterday was from a family member when asked how they felt about the materials that were found off the coast of Australia. And she said in wonderful English, we are cautiously pessimistic.
That's
about it, right?
Yeah, that is the human story here. And there was a good report on NPR, I think, yesterday that talked about how many of these families of these people that, you know, most of the people on the plane were Chinese, and many of them were the children of people who were farmers, you know, who were from rural areas. And they're all in the city now, you know, staying in this hotel. It's, you know, it's just a completely, probably worried about their farms, worried about their lives, very unfamiliar with their surroundings. It just has to be a hellish situation for them that just keeps dragging on.
And at what point do you dispatch them and say, you know what, go home, and then we'll figure this out? And only so you can kind of get back to some state of normalcy.
Well, let's transpose that question to us. And we are by and large, you know, bystanders just watching this out of curiosity's sake. At what point does CNN and the other networks, at what point do they say, okay, well, listen, nothing's happening, now we move on, and it's a back burner?
It's a great point.
We all know the answer to that, and that is when the ratings go down. As long as people are interested in, as long as the thing holds up. I remember when the Boston bombings happened and CNN's ratings went through the roof. I could be wrong about this, but I think they stayed out on the square where it all happened a couple of extra days after things, after
they did.
Shinaev and the other guys got hauled in. Because, you know, it was really working for them. I think as long as it works, they're going to do it.
Yeah, but it's a real problem if there's a huge appetite for news, whatever that is defined as, and there is no, you know, it's supply and demand, you know. A great demand for the news, but there's not an adequate supply here. There's so many unknowns that you get into technical stories about and the type of aircraft that search the ocean and et cetera.
Sure. But you know what they'll do. You know, that's a problem. You're exactly right. It's a problem. But it's a problem they'll gladly deal with as opposed to going away and going into third place again on the cables.
Right.
We've been talking about it for 2 weeks, you know?
Well, and you feel like you should because it is, I mean, to me, there's still the enormity of the story, which is that there is this jetliner with close to 300 people on it that is missing.
Yeah.
I mean, that is an amazing story, and it is a mystery.
But at what point
do
you say, well, listen, nothing new is happening.
Well,
let's
absolutely.
Do something
well,
else.
Well, right now, we still have searches. We still have the family involved. We still have satellite imagery that's coming in. I'm not saying that it's all credible. We don't know what it is, but there are still things that are fueling the story. I don't know. You know,
we just heard from Matt Wright, Joe.
Oh yes, Matt, I just got your text. Go ahead.
And he said, well, actually, we had another one on Russia, but this one's on this, and says standard is 40 feet times 8. In other words, the container. And he says, more pointless information from me.
All right, fair enough.
Matt in Rhinebeck.
I think we're out of time for the half hour here. Do we have time for one more email?
No,
there's one more.
Okay, go ahead. Is there one
on
more?
On Russia or not? Yeah. Yeah, there's one more. On Russia, the sanctions might seem to be ineffective, but they hurt the oligarchs in their pockets, and we are talking about big pockets. They will put pressure on Putin to moderate or even stop expansion. The sanctions on U.S. politicians are meant to mess with President Obama. Obama thinks 6 moves ahead and has no doubt, though, that of all the consequences of any U.S. retaliation. The sanctions also encourage EU countries to impose their own and adopt the same sanctions and present a unified front without hurting. Okay,
yeah, we're out of time, but we'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to our roundtable discussion, and let me introduce the panel to you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, WAMC newsman Ray Graff, an associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain. We welcome your comments roundtable at WAMC.org, and we have a couple of comments, right, Alan?
We do. John wrote a letter. I want to ask that everybody who writes letters keep them as short as possible. No reflection on John, of course. I was interested in the Thursday roundtable discussion regarding exaggeration of weather reporting to attract viewers, then followed a discussion on the role of speculating and reporting. I couldn't help noting that in all probability, a discussion of contradictions, inconsistencies, and intentional omissions of sanctioned opinion on no-go topics like the JFK assassination would not and will not in today's world receive similar courtesy in any mainstream left or right-leaning news organization. The lesson, I suppose, is that speculation about innocuous conspiracies are fine, but that of serious history-altering conspiracies are not. On a level playing field, I think we all know in our heart of hearts where the truth would land. And then we heard from Jeremy. Jeremy, what did he say? Well, I don't know what he said, but he said, and I remember the letter, although it's not easy for me to read here, that he thought you guys didn't get my allusion to the sneakers on the wire. And he said, and he said, tough room.
School's out. School's room. Out, and my sneakers are going on the phone
understood.
Wire.
We understood.
Tough room. Okay, good. So that's what he said, not me, of course. Let's see. Is there anybody? Oh, yeah, that's. And George said, I got the joke. Actually, very funny. Maybe.
Which joke was
maybe
that?
Everyone. my joke about the sneakers, you see. Very funny. Maybe everyone got it except the panel.
No, we got it.
Room. Okay, and on and on. And then there are more people, but that's it for now.
Okay, let us get back to our discussion and talking about what is going on in the world. And so, Mike, what is happening in the world of the Times Union?
Well, it seems like almost every day now, someone reports a new site in the capital region that's being proposed for the casino that will be selected for this region. The latest development is a story today by our reporter, James Odotto. He's telling about this new partnership between a Rochester developer and the Capital District Off-Track Betting Corporation. They're proposing a casino to be built just off Thruway Exit 23. That's the southernmost exit for Albany as you come up from the south on the Thruway. And currently the property is a compound of secluded homes where the prominent Noonan family lives. It's at the edge of the city, kind of straddling the border with the town of Bethlehem. And it includes the home where our own U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand grew up. And apparently the property is on the market. This developer, David Flom of Rochester, who had been behind a proposal to put the casino off I-90 at the former Tobin's First Prize packing plant, but backed off that now, is working with OTB in the region. He says it would give the Albany County millions of dollars in revenue, $10 million to the city itself, and for a city facing a $16 million budget deficit, that's difficult for them not to be interested in it. The mayor is not talking about this, Kathy Sheehan, but Flom is expected to make a presentation to city officials today. And by the way, he's a developer from out in the Rochester area, does a lot of shopping centers. He's also a member of Governor Andrew Cuomo's Republicans for Cuomo team. I'm just mentioning that. Well, I don't know that it means anything. They're envisioning a $300 million project here. They're calling it the E23 plan for Exit 23. He says it will create 1,800 permanent jobs, 1,500 construction jobs. The mayor of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, has expressed some concern about the project that's being proposed for just across the river from downtown Albany in Rensselaer County in the city of Rensselaer, saying that she's not in favor of downtown casinos. So maybe that's the prelude to her support for this newer project. And of course, you know, those applications all have to be in by June, and the state is hoping to start awarding these in the fall. So it's getting more interesting.
Well, you know, Mike, when you say, you know, I don't know that it means anything, you know, we were instructed in All the President's Men by Deep Throat to follow the money. And if somebody is giving money to a guy who has $33 million in his campaign account, then we at least have to be cognizant of the fact that most people who give you money probably want something back for it. That's all I'm saying. That's all. I'm just saying.
Well, he's got a $300 million
proposal. And there's some sneakers on the wire.
So the $10 million for Albany, is that a yearly or is that a one-shot deal? Because it strikes me that, you know, the deals that have gone on in Massachusetts and in other communities, you know, around the country are contingent upon a certain percentage of slot revenue going to the host city, a certain percentage going to the state. Have they talked about anything like that for Albany? Because a $10 million shot once, it might be okay if you have a $16 million deficit, but it's the future money that really counts in these deals.
Yeah, I don't know. The details are not all out. He's going to make a presentation to the Common Council at noon today, I'm sure that will be a question that will be addressed. But the 1,800 permanent jobs is also a big, a big selling point on this, if that is accurate. And it's an interesting, if true. I mean, you know, and everybody does certainly tell the brightest side of it. I mean, it's the same kinds of dynamics that are going on in Massachusetts, Western Massachusetts, as they're deciding all the terms of a casino going there. This is interesting because it kind of would make it easy to get from the south, from the New York City area. It's almost would have the access that the Catskills casinos would have, you know, just a little farther on the thruway, and you're right there. Get right off. It's not near anything. It's kind of
except
attractive.
The city of Albany.
Well, yeah, it's close, but I mean, it's not downtown. It's not like Schenectady is talking, you know, the developers of a new location for condos and waterfront marina and everything in Schenectady are talking about a casino now. And you know, that's a very different kind of character than this one that's kind of remote.
The interesting dynamic here, as far as I can see, is how this plays into, if this is a legitimate proposal, how this plays into Saratoga's disposition, which has been, at least reported to have been, very much against a casino expansion in Saratoga. Now, if suddenly, go ahead.
No, go.
Well, if suddenly Albany is a legitimate player, does that change the ideas for Saratoga? Go ahead.
Well, I said the other day, and I mean it, that what we are seeing as this emerges is that the places that are most receptive are the cities that are in the most trouble, or have big problems. So you get a Springfield, or you get parts of Schenectady, or you get an Albany. But it's very interesting to me to think about how much trouble a city like Albany is in, you know, compared to, for example, to a Springfield. And I think some PhD candidate is going to figure all of that out sooner or later because it makes great sense that a bigger city with bigger problems may be more receptive to these sort of quick fixes.
Well, the state is under pressure to help Albany right now. A lot of people are calling for an increase in pilot payments, you know, payments in lieu of taxes for all the state agencies that are on not taxable land in the city. And they're also seeking aid under the restructuring board, the state's restructuring board. If they have to make the decision about where the casino is going to go, maybe that'll be a factor. Well, maybe they'll figure if we give Albany the casino, they won't be hitting us up for all this other help. And, that may be what's going on here, some kind of a, or they're using the casino as a pressure point to get the state to pony up on the other end.
You know, Ray Graff, you have studied this stuff rather intensely.
No, I haven't.
And you've reported on it.
Some on-site visits as part of it.
come on now, that's cruel, and I would never say anything like that to Ray. But I was just wondering whether or not Ray.
Interesting, as you got known as the cruel one. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you see that?
Yeah.
The question is whether or not Ray, this is a place that a destination that people who go to casinos that, you know, some of your friends and others would go to as opposed to some of the other ones.
Well, I've been thinking about that. And, you know, I think that casinos in urban areas are not necessarily as attractive as ones that are sort of out in the middle of nowhere. The ones in Connecticut, obviously the folks who live there are would not say it's in the middle of nowhere, but it's in the middle of hundreds of acres of woods. And in a way, it's a destination. I wonder how the dynamic will play if it's in the middle of an urban center where I just don't know. I really don't know. It's different even in Atlantic City, which is somewhat, you know, you're told not, you go, you stay on the boardwalk, you go to the hotels, you don't go downtown. In Vegas, you're not milling around the city. You're staying where the casinos are. In Albany, I think it might be a different dynamic. I'm not sure how it'll work. The whole thing is took me by surprise.
Well, it's attractive to go off to a destination rather than just stop on the way home, I guess, you know, to some people. It's a state of mind.
Well, except, and one wonders about all those people who are addicted to gambling, whether or not, you know, this changes the dynamic of who comes in, drops by. You know, it takes a certain amount of effort to get on a bus or to get on a train to go somewhere. But also, I'm wondering whether when you get off at exit 23 and get into those to that area, which is owned by some politically connected people, maybe. Whether or not you ever get out of the thing, as Ray just said, and go into the challenged parts of Albany to help increase commerce.
Yeah, I think that that would not happen here. I think you'd get off the thruway, you'd go to this complex, and you'd go back on the thruway and go home.
That's how they're designed. Yeah, they want you to stay.
Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah, they don't want you to go off downtown and spend money. I mean, well, that's not intended.
That's one of the arguments in Saratoga. And I actually had a conversation. I won't mention the guy's name because it was just an off-the-record conversation. But he has been in contact with the business leaders, and they have been debating this in Saratoga. And he brought up there's a lot of sentiment against it. And he brought up the point, and he's not necessarily for it, but he said, gosh, if we don't get it, what are we going to feel like if somebody really close by gets it? And they all said, geez, I don't know.
Yeah.
So.
And it's going to play out pretty quickly. The applications have to be in by June, and the decisions probably will be made in the fall. So, you know.
Yeah. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org.
Support for WAMC comes from Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities, open 7 days a week, yeoldwarwickbookshop.com. Indian Mountain School, Lakeville, Connecticut, an independent co-educational junior boarding and day school for students from pre-kindergarten through grade 9, indianmountain.org. And Cindy McMahon Realty USA, serving the Capital Region, including Northern Columbia and Southern Washington counties, since 2003. GetCindySold.com.
I don't care. Do wanna know why I walk by and you stare. Do wanna know why, just do wanna know why. Do wanna know why, just do wanna know why.
Welcome back to our roundtable discussion. Just a few minutes left, a couple issues to get to. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan, we got a letter on casinos.
Yeah, we do. And it says, in this fever for developing casinos here in the Northeast, are casinos the sole exception to the economic law of supply and demand, or is it expected to be limitless demand for casino gambling? That's a very interesting question. You know, to some degree, the more casinos, the more the demand increases, obviously, because they're accessible and because they're around, I suspect. On the other hand, certainly Ray has pointed out that as you get more and more of them, the competition gets more fierce, and people will not go to some places they would ordinarily go to. Don't you think, Ray?
I think you hit a saturation point at some point. The casinos in Connecticut have seen falling slot revenue for some time now, and part of that is, of course, the economy. But part of that is competition in neighboring states. And, you know, eventually there'll be a casino on every corner, and then... How do you support that? You do not. You do not. So good letter. Good point.
Let's go on to, just as I mentioned, a few other topics before we end our conversation this morning. It's worth one item in the news today. The Reverend Fred Phelps, the virulently anti-gay preacher who drew wide, scornful attention for staging demonstrations at military funerals as a way to proclaim his belief that God is punishing America for its tolerance of homosexuality, died in Topeka, Kansas on Wednesday. He was 84 years old. The Westboro Baptist Church confirmed the death. Mr. Phelps, who founded and led Westboro Baptist, a small independent church in Topeka, was a much-loathed figure in the fringe of the American religious scene, denounced across the theological and political spectrum for his beliefs, his language, and his tactics. But he certainly did have a presence, and in this area too, right,
Mike? Right, he did. He came to some funeral, I think at least one time, to a funeral of a serviceman who died in, it was either Iraq or Afghanistan, I don't recall, but... and his group came in by, you know, and picketed across the street and carried their hateful signs that, you know, that this death and the war and the scourges of war against the United States was because we were allowing homosexuality, you know, and it was God's punishment. And he believes in an angry God. He believed, you know, the notion when you're in elementary school and you're learning God is love. Well, he didn't believe that. He thought God was hate. I mean, he said that. There were quotes in this obituary in the New York Times where he essentially said that. And,
well, he's going to find out now if he was right.
An angry, vengeful God. Yeah, well... Well, that's certainly great. But it is interesting. The Associated Press had quoted Sue Hyde, who's a staff member at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, who said that it actually, she believes that it forced people to confront their own views and roused a protective instinct in parents and friends of gays and lesbians. And she called it his actions when he was alive, his anti-gay actions, his profoundly, hateful rhetoric, a wonderful recruiting tool for pro-equality, pro-social acceptance, movement. The Phelps family, gave that to us. And that's a very interesting way to look at it. It really
did. Well,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's always this business about when somebody dies, there's a certain, you know, format, and you don't say things bad, you don't say bad things. So here's somebody who says, you know, he is actually a good guy. He was so terrible, that he actually helped us recruit people and to people to confront themselves, but he was terrible. I once went to my mom and said about a particularly bad politician that so-and-so had died, and she said, not a bad idea. And I have learned the hard way that you really don't criticize somebody on their way out, no matter how despicable, and that's as far as I'm going.
I did think it was interesting that in both the I believe I saw this in the Washington Post, where there was in the article accompanying the obituary was a whole article on whether of compelling reasons why not to protest at his funeral. And because there's now an entire movement for all of those military families of people to come and to protest at his funeral. There's sort of this debate going on over that. Mm. And the last I heard, there was some question as to whether they were even going to have a public funeral for that very reason. And it's interesting of how it's being depicted by different factions and how he impacted people. With what Alan just said in mind, I mean, I cannot believe. Certainly the military aspect of it, but anyone who is family and who is grieving should not have to go through anything beyond the initial grief of the loss of their loved one, of having people protesting across the street, and that of the person responsible for that. It seems hard to ever figure out how that makes sense or that why anyone should have to live with that. But
it also is an interesting legal story, because in 2011 the Supreme Court held that his church and its members were protected. This speech was protected by the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment, and they could not be sued for monetary damages for causing these stirs outside these funerals. I mean,
right.
So it is.
Which makes, sense. I mean, it's the right free speech and all of that. But I didn't realize his close ties was a civil rights lawyer, had worked for the NAACP, was disbarred. And then started this and started the church in Kansas.
That is amazing. That I did not know that either. Yeah.
Well, if we learned one thing from religion, if we are religious, it is that mortals do not judge and are not. It's not our right to judge. We don't judge others. And if we do that to him, then we fall into the trap that he was in. And so we should not judge him. Let the God or whatever you want to call him or her. Do the judging, not for us to do.
Very well, Parks.
I once got into terrible trouble with Mario Cuomo on this very subject. We were talking about what not to do and all the rest of it, and he was not for the death penalty, as you know. And I said, "What about Adolf Eichmann?" And there was a long pause. And I would say that to you here, Ray, in response to that. What about Hitler? What about Eichmann? You mean we should shut up? I don't know that that's right.
The ultimate judge is not you and not me.
No, I know that.
So there you go. And if you're an atheist, I apologize.
Well, why do I have to be the ultimate judge? Why not just one?
Well, you certainly are that.
I don't mean to digress, but we did want to say something very positive about the basketball team at the University of Albany that very well represented our region.
Nice
yesterday.
Job. Absolutely. They lost the game, but boy, it was close in both halves. It was far from a runaway. Absolutely.
Mark. A noble effort in defeat.
I think it was fantastic.
The headline in the Times Union today is Danes make Gators work. UAlbany tied with the number one team in the second half before taking the loss.
Here, here.
Yeah.
And finally, I want to say that I am not. I've never been happy with that game. It's a game for tall people, and it excludes many of us who are shorter, and therefore I don't like it.
Well, you know, there's been some pretty good Mutt and Jeff teams, you know, and the small guys have been instrumental.
Yeah, they always talk about Bob Cousy being a small guy. He was 6 what? You
know, there was a great guy at St. Bonaventure, Bill Cowball, who was 5'10", and he was phenomenal.
Hey, guys, show's over and all.
Okay, we got to go.
That's wrong.
Thank you very much, everybody. We'll be back with more Roundtable after this.